Chapter 3. As the buses unloaded, a trim and muscular army captain stood on a platform, patiently waiting for the group to get into some type of military formation. His folded arms rested against his chest, allowing his bulging biceps to inflate the end of his rolled-up fatigue jacket sleeves. He continued to shift his 200-pound, rock-solid frame from one foot to another, appearing both impatient and nervous. His deep tan and unblemished complexion accented his straw-colored hair and blue eyes. His green jungle fatigues were heavily starched and sharply creased, fitting like an outer skin, a real candidate for a U.S. Army recruiting poster. After 5 minutes, he turned on the microphone and began to speak.
"Good evening, gentlemen," he began. "I'm Captain Richards, and I'd like to welcome all of you to the 90th Replacement Battalion. As I call out your name, fall out into the building behind me. There you will exchange your greenbacks for military payment certificates."
MPC.
"Which is the currency used by Americans in this country. Greenbacks are illegal in Vietnam, and possession of any after you clear this area is a court-martial offense. After completing your money transfer, find an empty bunk in one of these 6 barracks."
He pointed out the buildings across the street and behind the formation.
"Tomorrow there will be shipping formations at 0800, noon, and 1600 hours. These readings are mandatory and everyone must attend. Those of you called out tomorrow will move on to your new units. The rest of you staying behind will work on projects around the center. Until that time, you will be on your own and free to use all the facilities available to you. Are there any questions?"
Scanning the formation, there are no hands raised.
"Okay, now listen up for your name."
The 90th Replacement Battalion was a large camp, measuring 2 miles long by 1/2 mile wide. Bunkers alternated with towers on the perimeter. To their front were varied configurations of razor-sharp barbed wire, stretching out for at least 500 feet. The 6-foot-high protective barrier resembled tangled spools of lethal thread. The small flares interspaced throughout awaited combustion when the engaged tripwire pins were pulled from the device, illuminating the immediate area in the dark of the night. Deadly claymore mines, positioned randomly around the perimeter, served as a first line of defense. Controlled remotely, detonators are accessible within each bunker. 2 quick squeezes on the clacker will blow the mines. Small metal cans full of loose stones bobbed in the wind. A sudden pull on the wire caused the cans to clang out a warning to the bunker guards. The barracks were single-story, green buildings and closely resembled their cousin buildings in the States. There was, however, one exception. No glass windows, just like in the buses. Instead, mosquito netting covered each opening. In the event of a rocket or mortar attack, these openings would provide additional exits for quickly vacating the building. The roof overhung sufficiently to keep rain from coming through the net windows. John stood waiting for Bill in the shade of a palm tree, just outside the money-changing building. The late afternoon sun hung low in the royal blue sky, but was still strong enough to make standing outside of a shaded area uncomfortable. When Bill finally exited, the two of them proceeded through the 95-degree heat toward the first barracks. They entered and luckily located 2 beds, side by side, at the far end near the back door. The two friends tossed their duffel bags onto the bare mattresses and flopped down beside them.
"Well, John, what are we going to do now?
You feel up for a walk to scout this place out?"
"Lead the way."
Bill worked his way out of the bed and onto the dirty plywood floor. They exited the building and walked down the 4 steps leading to the road, stopping briefly to look over the lay of the land.
"Let's find out why all those people are hanging around in the street," John suggested, pointing in that direction.
They walked up the road and came upon a large purple building. The sign on the door read, "Alice's Restaurant," a reference to singer Arlo Guthrie's 1967 hit folk song.
"Will you take a look at this?"
John asked excitedly. Latching onto Bill's arm, he pulled himself toward the building.
"It's a goddamn restaurant right here in the middle of a war zone. Let's go inside and check this out."
"Okay, I got your back."
Once inside, they found the restaurant divided into 3 sections, a dining room, a game room, and a bar. They hesitated for a moment in the doorway, taking it all in.
"How about getting something to eat?"
Bill asked, patting his stomach. He continued,
"I'm starved."
"Cool, I'm kind of hungry too." They sat at a table in the middle of the dining room. A young Vietnamese girl quickly offered them menus. She was about 4.5 feet tall, with long, flowing, silky black hair. She wore black silk pajama bottoms under a knee-high powder blue dress. Slits extended on both sides from her hips down. She was so tiny that she couldn't have weighed more than 80 pounds. She stood by the table with an order pad and pencil in hand, smiling politely, awaiting their order. Both quickly scanned over the single-page menu framed in black leather and covered with clear plastic. Items listed were hamburgers, hot dogs, fries, barbecued chicken, coleslaw, ice-cold soda, and beer. It only took a few seconds before they were ready to order. "I'll have a hamburger and fries," John said, handing the menu back to the server. "Oh, I'll have the same," Bill chimed in. "What do you want on your burgers? We have tomato, onion, ketchup, and mustard." "Oh, everything for me, please."
"Me too," Bill added.
"What would you like to drink?"
"What kind of beer do you have?"
"Falstaff, and Black Label is all we have."
"Ew," the men responded with sour expressions on their faces. The server saw that neither of them was happy with the selections.
"I'm sorry, but this is all we have,"
she apologized. John pondered over the choices.
"I've never tried Falstaff beer, so I guess I'll try one of them."
"A beer is a beer. I guess we shouldn't be fussy. Make it two of them Falstaffs."
Bill raised two fingers into the air.
"Okay, I'll be back in a minute with your beer, but your food will take a little longer."
She left to take the order to the kitchen. Her waist-length hair waved at them with each step, swinging gently from side to side. "You should be ashamed of yourself, Bill."
"What did I do now?"
Bill frowned, looking confused. "Did you hear that chick talk? You were born and raised in the States, and this Vietnamese girl speaks better American than you do."
"Oh, shit, you call that American? I speak excellent American, and her accent isn't anything close to mine."
They both laughed. The atmosphere in the restaurant was a refreshing change. It was so peaceful, a person would find it difficult to believe a war was even going on outside the perimeter. As they might have expected, the decor inside of Alice's restaurant catered to the peace-loving hippie movement. Posters of rock stars and the concert at Woodstock hung from the dirty white pine walls. Black neon lights helped to enhance the psychedelic posters and make the bright colors stand out. Gold-colored beads hung in the doorways and crackled like pebbles dropping onto the cement floor when someone passed through them. A strong smell of incense permeated the air. Several chimneys of smoke climbed lazily to the dimly lit ceiling at various locations throughout the building. The aroma was somewhat pleasant and did an excellent job of covering the stench of cigarette smoke and spilled beer. A jukebox played a variety of music, changing periodically from hard rock to soul music and even an occasional country western song. Suddenly, something interesting caught John's eye.
"Bill, there are slot machines in the next room."
"Wow, I've never played one before."
"Neither have I. Let's go and try one of them before the food gets here."
They jumped up and hurried over to the bank of nickel machines. Once there, neither of them had an idea of how to load their paper money into the machines because there was only a coin slot available. The new military payment certificates were all in paper, including the denominations less than a dollar. A nearby player observed their dilemma and volunteered.
"Go over to the cashier window and they'll change your Monopoly money for tokens."
Thanks,
both soldiers replied in unison and crossed the floor toward the cashier window. They exchanged a $5 MPC note for 100 nickel tokens and walked up to one of the 10 machines. Playing 3 tokens a pull and winning a few here and there, they were only able to play on the machine 7 minutes before losing all their coins. Disappointed, they returned to their restaurant tables to find their food and beers waiting. It was twilight outside when they exited the restaurant. Dim lights hanging from the front of each building enable them to see in the fast approaching darkness. Further up the road, the sound of music, cheering, and loud whistling made them curious enough to investigate. After pressing through the crowd, to their amazement, they found a 7-member band performing on a stage. 3 female dancers were half naked and slowly removing the rest of their outfits. The surrounding bleachers overflowed with cheering soldiers. Most were on their feet and roaring their approval.
"Oh, my God!"
Bill hollered above the noise. His mouth opened wide and his jaw dropped to his chest, exposing rows of pearl-white, filling-free teeth. His mouth moved up and down, trying to speak words, but nothing came out. He closed his mouth again and swallowed hard.
Well, come on, Polak. Let's go find us a seat.
Bill finally managed to spit out in between his heavy breathing. There were no seats available anywhere, so the two of them migrated to an area between the stage and the bleachers, joining other excited youths that were tightly packed into the small, crowded space.
Do you believe this? Bill asked. This sure is the first time I've ever seen anything like this.
You mean seeing the half-naked strippers or the live band? John joked.
I've never seen a naked lady in person before.
So what's the big deal? These Asian girls aren't shit. I've seen guys in basic training with bigger tits.
I did too, but they didn't affect me the same way. How often will we be able to see something like this?
Now, how in the fuck am I supposed to know that? Bill was unable to respond. He stood rock solid, hypnotized by the striptease taking place on the stage. The crowd in front of the stage tightened up and pulsated forward as more men arrived and tried to force their way in for a better view of the show. Pandemonium broke out when one of the girls was completely naked. The audience erupted in catcalls, whistling, waving fist into the air, clapping hands, and whooping it up. The bleachers sounded as if they were going to collapse from the impact of hundreds of feet stomping loudly on the wood boards. When the other two girls were also naked, the three of them began to dance wildly, gyrating in different directions and moving from one side of the stage to the other. Each of them made obscene gestures and teased the audience. After a full minute of individual flaunting, they all returned to center stage, slowly arching backwards and pumping their hips to the beat of the wild song. There was nothing left to the imagination now, and many in the audience were freaking out. Some soldiers had to restrain their friends in order to prevent them from rushing the stage and grappling the girls. The band had written this wild song. None of the Americans had ever heard it before. The rhythm was contagious and sounded like something out of a King Kong movie, inducing the girls to gyrate and work themselves into a sexual frenzy. Most of the men in the audience enjoyed this new sound, finding it difficult to watch the show without gyrating to the beat themselves. When the number finally ended, the girls quickly dashed off the stage and entered a portable dressing room. The musicians set their instruments to the side and joined the women in the small room. The audience was still in a high state of excitement, and now realizing that the concert was over, began to clap their hands and chant for the encore. Several minutes elapsed, and not one person had left the area. The chanting and clapping continued in hopes of convincing the band to return for one last song. The dressing room door finally opened, and the musicians burst out, running across the stage to their instruments. Seconds later, the three girls reappeared, dressed now in different colored silk robes, all using towels to wipe away sweat. The audience roared its appreciation. The lead guitarist began plucking out soft notes to quiet the crowd. The center dancer of the three picked up a microphone and smiled at the crowd.
We are the Crescent from the Philippine Islands, and we want to thank all of you for attending our concert. This will be the final song of the evening and is dedicated to all of you. Be safe and good luck.
Suddenly, the guitar tempo changed, and the band joined in, the dancers swaying from side to side. This song was heard many more times in various in-country concerts during the many months to come. The crowd quieted, and the girls began singing The Green, Green Grass of Home. The sad song stimulated memories of home and of those left behind. The rowdiness had ceased, and the atmosphere changed drastically to one of calm and sentiment. Many in the audience were singing along and swaying sideways to mimic the singers on stage. Bill and John left before the end of the song in order to beat the rush back to the barracks. When arriving, they found most everybody asleep, except for six people down on the far end of the building. Two of them were sitting on John's bunk. When approaching the group, they stopped talking and looked up to the new arrivals.
How are you guys doing? My name's John, and this is Bill. And seeing as you're sitting on my bunk, do you mind if we join you?
One of them, appearing to be the leader of the group, spoke up.
Oh, hell no, we don't mind. Come on and have a seat. This is Dan, Billy, Paul, Mike, Joe, and I'm Steve, he said, pointing them out when saying their names. We're just shooting the shit. This was the group's second night in the replacement center, and therefore they knew their way around the base camp. It was an opportunity for John and Bill to learn more about their temporary home. When interrupted, Paul had been in the middle of a story about a massage parlor on the next block. For the benefit of the new acquaintances, he started over from the beginning. It was a real bitch, man. They had 12 tables in this room. You strip in this little black closet, hang your clothes on a hook, and walk out with a towel wrapped around your waist. I got on the nearest table, where this forever smiling chick was waiting for me. There were at least 9 other guys getting massages at the time. Man, that chick had magic fingers. In the 15 minutes she worked on me, it felt so good that I almost fell asleep. She was just about finished working on my legs when, get this, she asked me if I want a hand job. Everyone laughed. Come on, Paul, don't stop now, said one of the guys on the bunk. Well, you know, it sounded pretty good to me, Paul continued. I never had a chick do that to me before. So I ask her how much, and she tells me, $12.
$12? Joe blurted out. Shit, I'll beat you for $12.
The laughter was so intense that it was difficult for the men to hold back the tears in their eyes. Come on, guys, Paul pleaded. Let me finish. It took a few minutes for the group to regain their composure. Finally, Dan volunteered.
Go on, Paul. We'll try to control ourselves.
Okay, well then, I told her that I only had $5 in my wallet, so I'd come back another day. Then she says, no sweat, G.I. I'd do it for $5. Shit, I thought that was a bargain. So I told her, okay. Now, instead of taking me somewhere else that was more private, she pulled my towel off right then and there and grabbed hold of me.
Dan and Billy elbowed each other in the ribs. Joe slapped his knee and started chuckling. Paul looked at them incredulously and continued.
That was the last thing in the world I expected. Man, I jumped right off that table, embarrassed as hell, and snatched my towel, wrapping it around my waist. She looked hurt, and some of the other people were looking over at us. I caught my breath, leaned over my mouth, inches from her ear, and told her calmly that I did not want her to do this right here in front of everyone. She smiled, looked straight into my eyes, and asked me if I was a cherry boy.
The small group could not take any more and began to howl and roll around on the two cots. The racket began waking some sleeping soldiers. They scowled at the group and told them to keep it down. Nobody wanted to start any trouble, so the group apologized and continued to converse in a lower tone.
I don't believe it. Our own Paul chickened out. Poor thing, couldn't handle the pressure,
Dan said sarcastically. Paul shot back coldly.
If you think you're such a badass, then why don't you go try it tomorrow? Show everybody what you have.
That'll be the day I pay some chick $5 to beat my meat,
Dan stated, nodding his head affirmatively and looking at the rest of the group for support.
Yeah, you probably do it every night too, don't you?
Paul retorted. Joe interceded.
Oh, goddamn it, Paul. Don't get bent out of shape. You know we're just fucking with you.
Paul sat there and fumed. It would take him a few moments to compose himself and allow the angry color to drain from his face. The group quickly changed the subject and began talking about other topics for the next couple of hours. As they were conversing, John could not help but notice the diverse regional accents and slang terms he was encountering for the first time in his life. It both fascinated him and made him feel a long way away from his home in Detroit. During one of the discussions, Dan informed Bill and John of the radio phone in the building next to the PX. The Mars station allowed a person to call home for a small fee. It was not a telephone, and both parties had to use proper radio procedures and military etiquette, such as saying, over, when one party finished talking, before opening the channel for the other to reply. Bill and John agreed to look into it the following day. In the morning, the first manifest included the names of those 6 soldiers from the late-night muster. Assigned to the 101st Airborne Division, they would be traveling north to a place called Fubai. Somebody in the crowd stated that the 101st was in dire need of replacements as the North Vietnamese Army, NVA regulars, were kicking their asses in a valley called the A Shao. Rumor had it that entire platoons were lost during those hardcore firefights. After all the names on the manifests are read, Bill and John left quickly to avoid any work details and headed straight for the Mars station, anxious to place a call home. Instead, they found a long line of prospective callers and observed several pages of names posted on the door. A waiting list. Neither had any idea how long it would take to rotate through the list, but added their names to it, just in case they were still at the replacement center when it was their turn.
With nothing else to do until the next reading in a couple of hours, both decided to walk around the center. They found an outdoor movie theater, another restaurant, a swimming pool, post office, two basketball courts, baseball diamond, and the notorious massage parlor. It was like visiting a recreation center or youth camp, with the only sign of war being the bunker line and barbed wire. After the noon manifest reading, those remaining soldiers filled in the holes and tightened up the formation. Several non-commissioned officers, NCO, weaved through the formation, grabbing personnel for various details. A young buck sergeant, looking younger than most of the men standing on the street, strolled through the formation and chose Bill, John, and a dozen other soldiers for painting detail. This time, nobody could escape. John and Bill's group painted in the hot sun all afternoon. Ironically, they were painting the fence enclosing the reception center's swimming pool. The water teased and beckoned to them all day. Finally, unable to control himself any longer, Bill dropped his brush, rushed through the gate, and jumped fully clothed into the refreshing and cool water. The rest of the men in the paint detail exchanged glances in stunned silence. Then, as if on cue, everybody dropped their brushes and followed Bill's lead. They splashed around in the water, unchallenged for several minutes, like a group of grade school children on a field trip. All at once, two service club attendants emerged and ordered them from the pool. Reluctantly, one by one, they emerged from the water and returned to their tedious detail. Clothes dried quickly in the hot, blaring sunshine, and soon they were all sweating again, contemplating a second dip in the pool. At 5 p.m, the project only required another hour to finish, but they were all relieved of their duty and told to go to the mess hall for dinner. After John and Bill ate dinner and cleaned up, they returned to Alice's restaurant. This time, their attempt to win on the slot machine was successful when Bill hit the jackpot with the first three tokens. Bill stood there dumbfounded and watched the hundreds of coins dropping into the tray below. Bells and sirens were sounding from the machine, and a red strobe light above signaled that somebody just hit the jackpot.
"Glory be, this sure is my lucky day. Just look at all these here coins," he cried out joyfully.
The noise and strobe light quickly attracted other soldiers, who began to gather around the two winners. Everyone watched the payout window. Numbers continued to climb and approached 1,000 fallen tokens already filling most of the tray below. Those standing around showed mixed support. Some congratulated Bill and were happy for him. Others simply looked on, saying nothing. One person in particular appeared to be quite upset, complaining loudly to his friend.
"Damn, I just left that machine. Had I stayed and played another coin, that jackpot would have been mine."
Someone turned and responded to him loudly.
"Yeah, but you didn't, and now it isn't, so get over it. Give the guy a break."
"Fuck it, don't mean nothing," he mumbled and walked away.
Meanwhile, Bill frantically raked the tokens into old coffee cans and found it difficult to keep up with the machine payout. The counter was still rolling, and it passed 1,400. It stopped suddenly at 1,500 and was quiet again. Someone yelled out,
"Way to go, man, you just hit for 75. Don't spend it in one place."
It took several more minutes for the two of them to transfer all the coins from the machine tray into empty coffee cans. When they finished, they muscled the five filled cans over to the cashier cage. The woman behind the counter congratulated them and paid Bill in military certificates.
"Come on, Pollock, it's time for us to drink a few beers and celebrate,"
Bill said proudly, guiding John to a nearby table. After a few hours of drinking beer, both were surprised to find that neither one of them could stand without support.
"Oh, shit, I can't see things clearly anymore," John stated, holding on tightly to the back of his chair.
"I can see okay, but everything's spinning like I'm on a merry-go-round," Bill slurred.
"Are you going to puke?"
"I don't think so right now, but we need to find a way to get back to our bunks.
I do remember that we have to turn left and go to the last row of the barracks on top of that hill."
"Let's get started, before we pass out."
The two of them leaned onto one another, shuffling through the door and then down the steps to the road. Some of the bystanders watched them closely, amused by their inebriated state. Once they reached the road and turned left, the two soldiers started singing marching tunes from basic training while weaving across the road. Both were off-key and very loud, one trying to sing louder than the other. Angry voices echoed in the darkness from every building they passed.
Hey, assholes, pipe down.
Shut the fuck up out there.
Sing another note and I'll personally come out there and kick your ass.
They disregarded the threats and warnings, not stopping until they reached their destination. Once inside, they collapsed. At 0300, the loud blast of air raid sirens abruptly awakened the inhabitants of the 90th Replacement Battalion. Those drunk or stoned sobered up immediately. Chaos reigned. Cherries spilled out from the barracks, most escaping through open doorways. Others, choosing speed instead, dove through the openings in the sidewalls. In doing so, the mosquito netting pulled from the walls and encapsulated many of the fleeing youths in a nylon cocoon. This further enhanced their panic. Outside, the men bump into one another, confused and unsure of what to do next. A voice on the public address system began yelling barely audible instructions above the shrill sirens.
Yellow alert! Yellow alert! Head for the nearest bunker and take cover immediately!
Thankful for the directive, everyone raced toward the available bunkers. Once inside, the men sat nervously on the ground. All were trying to control their breathing, gasping as if just completing a 10-mile race. Voices rang out from the total darkness within.
My heart's pounding so fast, it's going to explode.
What in the hell is happening?
Are we getting hit?
Where are our weapons?
Yeah, how are we going to protect ourselves?
What in the fuck does yellow alert mean?
The sight within the bunker was also bizarre, with 20 soldiers all in different levels of dress. Some were barefoot, wearing nothing else except green boxer shorts. One of them even wore a helmet. Others wore just a pair of trousers and boots. Another bunch, only a shirt and shorts, and three men stood in complete uniform with helmets. One of the cherries stood next to the entrance of the bunker, holding a broom, the handle facing outward like a bayonet on a rifle. Just then, a heavyset person wearing a cook's hat and apron leisurely strolled into the bunker and took a double glance at the person standing guard with the broom. Shaking his head side to side, he took in the curious picture. Of course, since he had been at the replacement center for almost 4 months, similar scenes had played out repeatedly.
Relax, guys. It's only a test,
he said in a reassuring voice.
What do you mean, a test?
A voice snapped in the darkness.
The camp officers fuck with us every other night and run this alert at different hours. It's supposed to remind us that we're all still at war. It doesn't bother me any, because I'm in the kitchen all night long cooking. The siren should stop, and they'll give us the all clear in another minute or two.
What a bunch of lifer motherfuckers, someone mumbled.
At least they could have given us some warning. Now I've got to clean the shit out of my pants,
said another. 5 minutes later, the all-clear sounded. Everyone began to file out of the bunker, returning to the barracks, thankful but pissed off about the inconvenience. Almost everyone dropped onto their bunks, but were unable to return to their dreams, still too shaken to sleep. Most just lay in bed awake until dawn. Bill Sayers and John Kowalski heard their names called during the first shipping formation of the day. Both men got orders for the 25th Infantry Division. A division base camp was near the city of Cu Chi, which is 20 miles northwest of Saigon. Their convoy was leaving at 1000 hours.
Thank you, sweet Jesus, Bill said solemnly. Thank you for not sending us up to the 101st.
Amen, John added. Those called for the morning transport began arriving at the pickup point, duffel bags in hand, dropping them in the area designated for the 25th Division. With an hour remaining before departure, Bill and John rushed over to the PX to purchase boonie hats. They are very similar to those worn by amateur anglers. The soft, green, cloth-like material enabled a person to shape it into any configuration necessary to protect their eyes and back of the neck from the blazing sun. They were lighter and more practical than the traditional baseball caps worn by new recruits. While both waited for a tailor to embroider their names on the hats, John scanned the showcase, filled with division patches.
Bill, let's get us a patch for the 25th Division and have it sewn onto the hat, too,
John suggested. They were not sure what the patch looked like, but thankfully located a display board that identified these unit patches. The patch for the 25th Division looked like a red strawberry, 2 inches wide by 4 inches long, with a yellow lightning bolt piercing it diagonally. Each purchased one and had them sewn in place. John moved to the next counter, noticing a large Bowie knife among the many knives in this showcase. He immediately purchased it.
Check this out,
he called over to Bill.
John had already threaded his belt through the leather scabbard. With the knife now hanging from his right hip, he was tying the bottom leather lace around his thigh.
"That knife looks cool as hell," Bill said, admiring the new item.
"Makes me look kind of badass, doesn't it?" John asked proudly.
"Yes, it does. I think I'll buy one for myself," Bill said, then placed his order with the salesperson.
Neither of them thought of a knife as being much more than a decoration. However, they would both find out later that it was the most valuable tool used while patrolling through the jungle. At 0930 hours, 5 2.5-ton trucks, commonly called deuce-and-a-half trucks, arrived. A layer of sandbags were piled upon the bed of each truck to protect the riders if the truck should hit a mine in the road. A soldier stood behind the cab, working on the tripod-mounted M60 machine gun on the roof. The Rat Patrol jeeps arrived to escort the Cherries to their next destination. Bill and John were among the first 20 to board the trucks, and fortunate enough to get a seat on one of the two pull-down benches running the length of the truck bed on both sides of the vehicle. The other 15 had to sit in discomfort on the hard, sandbag-covered floor. The convoy moved out precisely at 1000 hours. Once leaving the security of the 90th Replacement Battalion, a lone helicopter gunship joined the convoy and circled lazily overhead, providing additional security for the parade of 5 trucks. They passed endless rice paddies, where the Vietnamese people worked painstakingly to harvest their crops in knee-deep water. Young boys rode on top of huge water buffaloes, whacking the big brown animals on their rump with a bamboo stick. Whenever a convoy passed from the opposite direction, everyone raised their arms and flashed peace signs to one another. Every now and again, the passengers saw the front of an armored personnel carrier, APC, poking out from a stand of bushes on the side of the road. Their gunners acknowledged the fellow Americans, waving enthusiastically to the convoy from behind 50-caliber machine guns. Traveling at speeds in excess of 40 miles per hour, it took no time at all for the convoy to reach Cu Chi, home of the 25th Infantry Division.